From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, you've now heard from the State Commissioner of Education, Mary Ellen Elia. And this hour, it's a chance to hear a range of voices responding to the commissioner's comments. We already have a stack of listener feedback from the first hour, and we will get to that coming up. Commissioner Elia talked about teacher evaluations, standardized testing, mentoring, how to retain teachers in struggling districts, and more. She talked about the climate, the relationship between teachers and state government, and whether that she has seen that improve in 3 years. Well, our guests this hour have a lot to say on a wide range of subjects, and in studio, I want to welcome them now. Van White is the Rochester City School Board President. Van, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan.
Adam Urbanski is Rochester Teachers Association President. Adam, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also with us is Christopher Albrecht, a fourth grade teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport, and oh, by the way, New York State's Teacher of the Year. Christopher, welcome back.
It's an honor to be back on the show.
There is a lot to discuss, and what I think what I want to do first is talk about the most news-making of the subjects that of the many that the commissioner talked about, and that is what's going on in the Rochester City School District and her desire to see a, quote, distinguished educator. And before we even listen to what our guests have to say, my mind goes right back to last week. We had Adam McFadden talking about very different subjects. He's a member of Rochester City Council, but boy, did he want to talk about this one, and the idea that there should be a distinguished educator appointed to help oversee some changes in the Rochester City School District. He wanted to talk about it, so I asked him, what do you think of the commissioner's plan?
Joke. It's my thought on it as a joke. You have an elected school board who makes decisions, and they made a decision on a superintendent, and they have to trust that they made the right decision and they work together. We keep trying to find a Superman to fix decades of destruction. That's not going to work. Just like their rules for, you know, closing a school. It hasn't worked for us. We're not fixing anything. So I'm really frustrated by her leadership. And that's just me, because I just think that, you know, these things are done for news headlines and not for our children.
Okay, let me start with the president of the Rochester City School Board. Mr. McFadden calls it a joke. What do you think of the distinguished educator?
I wouldn't call it a joke, but I got to tell you, I understand his frustration. And I have said, I don't know if he said it first, I said it first, or somebody else said it. We do have a tendency in this nation, not just in the state, not just in the city, to look for a Superman or Wonder Woman to fix all of our ills. And the popular movie, which dealt with a different subject, is appropriate to when people say waiting for Superman. I think people are waiting for a singular person to attempt to fix all of our problems. Now, having said that, let me say that we are, to fix this problem, we don't need a Superman or Wonder Woman. We do need an Avengers. Anybody who likes the Marvel comic series, there's an Avengers-style leadership team, people drawing on different powers and abilities of different people. I think that kind of approach does work. So in that regard, in that spirit, this distinguished educator who she has identified might be one of the many people that would sit around this table and have a conversation about what else can we do or what might we do differently to improve the outcomes for our students. So I understand and really do appreciate Adam's frustration, although I come out a little bit differently, because I look at this gentleman's background as compared to the prior one that she had recommended. I think his name was Dr. Eastwood. And I didn't think he had what was necessary to sit at the Avengers table. I didn't think he had the powers, the abilities, the background, the experience to offer something different. I do think, given this gentleman's background, I do think he may have something to offer. And so we welcome him, just like we welcome Adam and the mayor and all sorts of people to this table to help us address our problems and challenges.
But does he have too much emphasis or power or control?
No. I mean, you heard the commissioner say, and I'm glad she said it. I think you might have asked the question. Her response was, no, he doesn't have the ability to say yes or no. Okay. He has no authority. He can't manage. He's not. He doesn't have any ability to hire or fire anybody, spend money or don't spend money. He's a person who, if he didn't have the title, I'm sure Adam and others would say, we welcome people to the table to help us address our challenges.
Adam Urbanski, is this the right step for this district?
Well, it's a step. I don't know if it's the right step. I certainly know that it's not a sufficient step. But my understanding is that this is a person familiar with urban education. This is a person familiar with dealing with students, majority of whom are students of color. It's another pair of eyes, another pair of ears, to offer observations. And I think President White is right. He's got no authority to negate what the board does or what the superintendent does. He's here to observe and then to offer his perspective to the commissioner. And then the commissioner would share that with the Board of Education and with the City School District Administration. Let's wait and see. Give it a chance and see what happens. I don't think it would be the right thing to reject an offer for another person to come here and offer another perspective.
Okay. Is this out of your purview, or you want to take a whack at this, Chris?
Oh, I'll gladly take a whack at this, yeah. The one concern that I have, as I've read about Mr. Aquino, is, you know, he's coming out of urban environments right now, and we have a very strong emphasis right now on urban environments, but we are facing the same issues out in rural areas around Rochester. I know Pittsford was brought up in the interview, but I don't know if that's a fair assessment considering a lot of the different rural communities that we have that are facing some of the different issues that are similar to the Rochester City Schools. I know out in Brockport we are outperforming Rochester City Schools, and therefore it's become a focus. But my advice to Rochester City School District is just to make sure that Mr. Aquino has his finger on the community's pulse as well as the school's pulse, because a lot of the different issues that the city of Rochester is facing, and I did spend some time in the schools in Rochester as State Teacher of the Year, a lot of the issues that we're facing are not just in the school, but are generated out of the community and out of some of the homes that some of these kids are coming from. They're coming from some challenges. I know poverty was a very strong theme in the interview that you had with Commissioner Elia. I would encourage him to not just look at the school, but also look at the community as a whole. You cannot separate communities and schools. They really have to be one to be successful.
There's a lot we talked about. And before we get to some listener feedback, I want to talk to all of our guests about their thoughts and what they heard about the question of how we evaluate teachers. Commissioner Elia made it clear that in her work in Florida, the model was different than it is here. And she is not committing to any sort of a number. We talk about how much should test scores count for a teacher evaluation. Well, she made it pretty clear in the interview. It shouldn't be 50%. She thinks that's too much. But she didn't commit to a number. 40% seemed to be even a little high in her mind. So it left me thinking, I don't know, a quarter? It was hard to kind of discern exactly where we're going. But it's certainly clear that the commissioner thinks it's too much currently. And let me just kind of go around the table, and I'll go back. I'll start with Christopher Albrecht. When it comes to test scores and evaluations, are we out of whack? What direction do you think we should be going in there?
Right. The more emphasis that we put on test scores, the more emphasis that we put on teachers teaching to that test. I mean, if we really put that kind of stress on these tests, it has a negative effect on children, because eventually it's going to boil down to, well, this child got this score right here. I think that's unfair. The one thing that is done that's not really understood is when a child's tested, let's say in third grade and moves on to fourth grade, they're compared to their cohort from the year before. So a child that's starting low and all of a sudden that teacher inherits them the next year and they do get a low score, they still could have a growth score. So it's not necessarily how many ones, twos, threes, and fours you have in your class. But the one thing that I think is happening is it's dictating some of the instruction in the class. I believe sincerely that what we teach right now is getting highly publicized, and how we teach is not getting enough value. We need to go back to those time periods of reaching out to our communities, our teaching methods in our classroom, but we're talking tremendous amounts of conversation, and we're spending lots of money and time on spending curricular time on things, and we really need to look at how we're teaching, because each district has a different culture, a different thought process to it, and those need to be explored. Connections to the home, I think, are the number one factor for increasing if we want to go with test scores. But I would rather say not test scores. Let's talk about student achievement and preparation for life.
Okay. Adam?
Well, I would agree with what Chris is saying, but let me say two things about that. Number one, 50%, of course it's too much. But it's even a larger point is that this is the wrong conversation. The question isn't whether it should be 50% or 40% or 30%. The question is, how do you use test scores? Right now, test scores are used as verdicts on students, schools, and teachers. Test scores should never be used as verdicts. They should be used as information. And accountability for teachers should be a process where they take those test scores into account and then account indicate how that information leads them to changing their practice to diminish the likelihood of failure and increase the likelihood of success. As long as we're using test scores as guillotines, as verdicts, we're having the wrong conversation. When we start using it as information, important information, then we'll be on a path to recovery.
Are we anywhere close to that right now?
Or we're nowhere close to that. Right now, testing in this state is absolutely ridiculous. It rarely has anything to do with what the kids are supposed to be learning in a classroom. Secondly, they're very often, most often, age inappropriate. Thirdly, they usually don't mean anything, and the students know. I mean, if you're a teacher, you know that the first question a kid is going to ask is, does it count? These tests don't really count. So kids don't really take them seriously. So I think that this is a very costly, futile exercise that robs students of time that they could be using for learning instead of these meaningless tests.
Blow it up, start over?
And well, it's junk science. It should be declared as junk science. And we should go to a teacher evaluation system that is more professional. For example, how do you evaluate a physician? By other physicians who are knowledgeable about the practice. You don't evaluate them by their morbidity rate or how well their patients are doing with their diets or with their habits. So I think once we start considering teaching as a genuine profession, then we will also adopt a professional evaluation system, not this moronic system that we're now trying to fix by diminishing the percentage of the amount that the tests count for.
Okay. Van White?
Yeah, I think that there's other forms of testing. I mean, here's the thing. I think you do have to assess where your students are at. I mean, it's just, in my mind, it would be absurd to have an educational system that didn't have some way to determine where your children are at. But there are other forms of assessments. Performance-based assessments are used with a great degree of success. We have one such example school, School Without Walls. It's part of the consortium network. They don't use tests to assess the student's success, and it graduates some of, it's one of our higher performing schools in our district. So I think we have to be a little bit more sophisticated about how we test, but I don't want anyone to get lost, and my colleagues here haven't suggested this, but I don't want anybody to suggest that we shouldn't be, in some form or fashion, assessing the success of what not just teachers are giving to our students, but what boards of education are giving to their students, superintendents in terms of books and professionals that are put before them. So I think assessment is important. I think we should be a little bit more creative about the tools that we use to assess the success of our endeavors as adults.
Adam wants to add to this, and then what I want to do is make sure our panelists give us an idea for, it's one thing to say, I don't like the current evaluation system. Adam started to do that when you talk about doctors evaluating doctors. I'm assuming teachers evaluating teachers.
But what I would add, building on what President White said, the one thing that we could do right away that would fix the overwhelming majority of the problem is stop asking on a test, what do students know, and start asking, what are they able to do with what they know? In other words, if these assessments required application of knowledge, I think the majority of the objection that teachers have to assessments would dissipate, and there would be credibility that we've never had before in tests on these kinds of assessments.
Okay. Chris, you want to add to that?
Sure. I agree with Mr. Urbanski. The ultimate goal of public education is graduation, and that we get our students prepared for our communities. We want our communities to be successful. We want our people to be healthy in our communities. We want to lower violence. We want our poverty issues to go away. And the one way we do that is by providing schools that are that children feel comfortable in, and not just that, but parents or grandparents or whoever, you know, whatever house the child's living in wants to participate in. And that's where I continue to advocate that reaching out into the community, even when we're talking about state testing right now, that reaching out into the community and making sure that we are bringing people on board is essential. The testing has put up a barrier that's a wall that cannot, it has to, I would say, would have to be knocked down. It's the way we're using it. I totally agree with Mr. Urbanski. The way we're using data right now is absurd. To evaluate a teacher with data affects the way a teacher will be instructing. Whether people want to call a spade or not, I will call a spade that if there's testing involved, there's something that is mimicking state testing in most classrooms, including out where I am and including in the city. That kind of instruction right there is not preparing our students for the real challenges of the real world.
Does it hurt you as a teacher? I ask because one of the reasons you're Teacher of the Year in this state is because of your creativity and the way the community appreciates your approach here. So you've found ways to be creative. You've found ways to connect with people, with families, with students. Does the testing regime hurt that among your colleagues?
I would say sometimes. I definitely know. I don't think it gives an individual hurt between teacher and parent relationships. I think the teachers that I work with have outstanding relationships with their parents and grandparents where children are living. But what I do think it does is it puts a barrier between the teacher and the curriculum, that we're so curriculum-driven, we're so curriculum-driven in the way that it's affecting the way we instruct, when we really need to go back to teaching things like civics, humanities, those types of areas where we are ignoring those because we are very, very content-driven right now.
Do you trust the commissioner is moving in a direction that is the kind you'd want to go in with this?
The direction the commissioner's going, well, I'm glad that she's being open-minded. I think she's right now, based on the what we heard last hour, I would say that she does not at this time have a number in mind in terms of a percentage. And I think all of us are kind of shooting from the hip right now at what percentage. We have to have a set percentage.
When Christopher says percentage, you mean the percentage of the weight of the evaluation that test
on an APPR. So yeah. I would say the weight it is for teaching. And I would say, honestly, 0% would be the way to go, simply because then if that's the case, we do need an evaluation system. So, President White, I absolutely agree with you. We need to be evaluating our students on an equal playing field to see how we're doing it. But the other thing is, are we preparing our students to take a test properly, or are we preparing our students to cognitively be ready and affectively be ready for the real world?
You know how you know a good test from a bad test? A good test is one that you can prepare students for and that you can judge them by. For example, if you want to know if a student knows how to ride a bike, you don't give them a paper and pencil test on riding a bike. You say, here's a bike, show me if you can ride, show me if you can swim. So same here, employers want to know what you are able to do with your knowledge, application of knowledge. If we had the kinds of tests or assessments that actually required students to apply their knowledge, we would then have more credibility in those tests, and then they could count for as much as you wanted to count. So the conversation about 50% of the current test or 40% is really not the right conversation. What the right assessment system is the right conversation. So if we have good tests, then we want a high percentage. If you have bad tests, then we want either zero or as low as we can keep it.
Okay. Are we going in the direction that you'd like to see with this commissioner?
Last time I had a conversation with the commissioner, I suggested to her that maybe while we're trying to find our way, she would support allowing some school districts or some schools to try out more creative, more appropriate forms of assessment and provide some incentives for that, some funding for that, and some freedom to do that, right? She said she's open to that conversation. We haven't concluded that. I haven't heard back yet. But I think that she would support that. I think I agree with what Chris had said, that she seems to have an open mind. She wants to do the right thing. But she will not, she is not more likely to come up with what would be the right thing than the educators themselves. They're the experts.
Okay. Van, do you think that we're going in a direction you'd like to see with this commissioner on evaluations?
Well, as they say in my other line of business, the verdict is still out. I'm not willing to say I think she's moving in the right direction or the wrong direction, because she said on there, I haven't decided what that number should be.
Right.
She said, I don't think it's 50%. I think she said that's not right, but... I would agree, though, that we as a nation are preoccupied with testing, and I think that tends to distort the mission of teachers, principals, paraprofessionals, school board members, and superintendents. I don't know what she's going to suggest is the fix, but I have heard Chancellor Rosa, Vice Chancellor T. Andrew Brown, talk about their concern about this preoccupation. But I'm not going to say, oh yeah, they're moving in the right direction based on their thought process. I want to see what they're going to do first. And by the way, that's the same standard people apply to me. They're not listening to what I say on this radio station. They want to see what the results are. And by the way, we practice what we preach. Adam was just talking about this. Basically, what we're talking about is performance-based assessments. What do I do? What's the ability what's my skill set and my ability to implement what the citizens of this community want? So. Again, I'm going to wait to see what she does, not what she says.
Okay, fair enough. Listeners, if you want to join the program, we've got a pile of emails to read in a moment in our second half hour. And if you want to call, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You heard from the State Commissioner of Education, Mary Ellen Elia, last hour. This hour, Van White, Rochester City School Board President, Adam Urbanski, the President of the Rochester Teachers Association, and New York State's Teacher of the Year, Christopher Albrecht, are all here discussing what they heard. Now, I told the commissioner that I thought she was dodging on the subject of the relationship between teachers and the state. I found it strange, but she says, look, she came in 3 years ago, and things had sort of cooled down among Governor Cuomo, teachers' unions, NYSET, teachers in general. Certainly in 2014, there was a lot of heat with the governor saying that he wanted to, quote, get rid of bad teachers, that he was tired of feeling like it was hard to get rid of a bad teacher and that was a big problem in education. Teachers were firing back, saying that they felt like they were sort of under assault as a profession. It felt like there was a lot of heat. Now, she claims not to have really been all that aware of that, which, I told her I thought it was a dodge, but she does think that at least the climate's, you know, it's pretty constructive now. And, you know, we'll ask our guests, Adam, have things changed in 3 to 4 years? Is it more constructive state government to teachers? And do you feel like for someone who's 18 or 20 or 21 thinking about their career, teaching looks more attractive now than it did a few years ago?
Yeah, I can hardly think of a more worthwhile way to spend a professional lifetime.
Well, of course, you
than in teaching,
but
yeah.
Is it better?
And it's a very rewarding life, and I'm doing my best to do what I can to also make sure that it's reasonably well-paid profession. But teaching is only effective if you have the right teaching conditions. So even a brilliant teacher would be hampered by conditions that aren't conducive to good teaching, like in any other profession. Is the commissioner right in saying that the climate today is better than 3 years ago? Yes, she is. And she's also right when she says that a lot of that is out of her control. It's where the governor happens to be. It's where the legislature is. It's where the relationships are. So I think things have improved. But as Van White said, I would love to see more results from that improved environment. Right now, our district is not faring well as measured by these test scores. But here's an exercise for anyone listening. Pick any municipality in this country or in the world and look at the individual, rank the individual communities like suburbs and cities and so forth by average family income. And then do another column juxtaposed to that of the average graduation rates and test scores and so forth, and you will see a virtually one-to-one correlation. So when the commissioner said that she's not sure whether poverty would ameliorate, yes, it would.
I was frankly stunned by that.
Yeah.
I was.
Yes, it would. But poverty may have a predictable impact, but it doesn't have a deterministic impact. In other words, kids who are poor not only can do well, but they have even more reason to want to do well because that's their only ticket out of poverty, education. I know that from my own personal experience, having come here as an immigrant without a penny and six brothers and parents who never went to school. And I know that from my many, many years of living in this community and in these schools. So I think we should stop dodging that question. We need to decentralize poverty. Right now, it's not mostly an individual person's poverty. It's the concentration of poverty that creates the kind of climate that actually impedes good education generally.
Yeah, and so Van, that part surprised me because I don't at all think that someone like Mary Ellen Elia or anyone at this table would say, yep, it's poverty first and fix poverty, you fix education. Reform efforts are you know, futile. I understand you've got to try within existing frameworks to do everything you can to get around the challenges that are in place because of years of economic inequality with, if we're being blunt and honest about it, racist systems that have been really created, entrenched, and perpetuated. So I was surprised to hear her say that, but maybe it's because she, look, you don't want to just throw in the towel and say mm-hmm. you can't change anything. So I get that, but I do think from my own work and trying to understand these issues, poverty is pretty central here. I think you have a very difficult job in the Rochester City School District because of our history here.
Well, and this is to this English educator. This is why I think he is a person that could help us at that table because he has some experience in understanding that. As I said, the prior appointee didn't have that kind of experience. If I were the commissioner, I listened to that portion of the interview, I would have said it a little bit differently, almost the way Adam said it. Poverty is not an excuse to the outcomes we have, but it is an explanation. So, for example, this is one that I think will resonate with many people in this community. This community, like many urban centers, had a significant problem with lead poisoning, right? Most of the housing stock in the city was built prior to 1975, mid-70s, when the regulations went in with respect to lead in paint. So whenever you open up, I'll try to keep it brief, whenever you open up or close a window sash and the dust that is on that paint floats in the air and then goes into a child's system. Mm-hmm. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV, but I do know this, that lead amounts to permanent cognitive and behavioral challenges. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even talking about other things relating to poverty. I'm talking about lead right now.
Just lead, yep.
Just lead.
Yep.
So it is not accurate to say that a city with the housing stock, an old housing stock that we have, folks that don't have the resources necessarily to properly abate lead in their houses and landlords that don't pay attention to that, have children that live in that environment that will ingest that. And thankfully, this is a community that got aggressive about that and made some improvements. But my point merely is poverty does explain the challenges that parents have in making sure their kids get a proper education, that teachers have in making sure their children. Now, that is just one example. You could talk about prenatal care as an example, health care. I mean, what kinds of meals children get, the structure of the family, all those things. The transient nature of many families because they have to move from poverty causes them to move from place to place, which causes some instability in terms of the educational environment. My point is, it's not an excuse because, hey, the reality is black folks, all kinds of folks have been very successful in impoverished conditions in terms of education. Shoot, we were slaves. right? And we found a way to be educated. So we're not saying that we can't and we haven't been successful. Many people have. But the reality is that poverty amounts to a significant challenge to the educational process. And here's the overall numbers. This is the last thing I'll say. Rochester, New York ranks third or fourth worst in amongst America's 75 largest cities. Fourth worst amongst America's 75. So Rochester has a very unique, as Adam or somebody said earlier on, problem with concentrated poverty, mm-hmm. unlike any other urban center in this country.
Christopher Albrecht.
Mm-hmm.
You want to add that?
Yeah. Well, poverty definitely is one factor, I would say. I would not say that it's the entire factor, but there definitely, I agree with Mr. Urbanski again, on that if you made a list and you saw incomes, you saw family incomes and people living in poverty, and you saw, you know, performance, I think there is a definite link between the two of them. But let's remember one thing. Children are raised in poverty. They don't choose to behave differently. I think when somebody's poor, we need to stop that image of, well, this person's poor, therefore. I would definitely agree with President White right there. Poverty is not an excuse for doing poorly. But a child being raised in poverty is definitely facing different stresses than a child that's not being raised in poverty. So if there are things that are not being provided in the home, I mean, we've got kids in Brockport that are coming to school and they are fed breakfast and lunch and may go home and not get dinner right there. Those children are facing different issues that are possibly a result of poverty, but there are other issues right there. I would encourage, actually, the commissioner to start looking at a more proactive approach of how do we teach our young adults at the high school level, not just health skills, but how do we start teaching things like civics and civic responsibilities, humanities, and also how do we remain, you know, whether it's marriage or raising children, how do we do that and prepare our students properly so when they exit our schools, we are not having a population of children coming into kindergarten not prepared. So I would say that there needs to be a proactive approach as well as a reactive approach. We need a Band-Aid right now, but we need to look at the long term.
Let me grab a phone call on the subject of poverty. This is Allie in Rochester. Go ahead, Allie.
Yeah, good afternoon. I came in a little late, but speaking very specifically on the poverty piece, I grew up in New York City. I went to city schools. I went to school with kids who were poor, black, white, green, red, it didn't matter. But the kids that I went to school with at that time who were poor, there were some kids who had it worse than others, but poor meant that you had like two slices of white bread and a piece of bologna, and somebody like made sure that maybe your clothes were washed in the sink and your conversations happened at home. I am seeing in classrooms where these are children of outlaws. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way. I mean, these are children whose parents have had really bad experiences with the law. I have had literally half my kids raise their hand in a time where half of them all had parents in jail. They have seen things that not just poor people. So I agree completely. Poverty has nothing to do with it. You can have the tiniest bit of food and just enough, but if there's love and there's interaction and there's talking and there's sharing, there's growth of spirit. But many of my kids, I mean, they'll go to an after school and not be picked up till 8 at night. And, you know, they go to somebody's house and they wake up at 11 at night and then they go home and then they shower and then they... It's not a money thing. It's what's going on at home, probably because of the racism that has been going on in Rochester all these years. And that, I guess that's my main point, is it's not just money. That's not the piece. The piece is not the money and the poverty. It's having parents that, you know, stab each other or pulling your mother off of her sister so she doesn't hurt her and having your father break into you. These are all real things that happened to my second grade student.
Yes. Allie,
I'll stop.
No. I appreciate the phone call. I mean, Allie's talking about trauma. And so all I would say to Allie's point, as someone who tries to marshal conversations in productive directions on these very complex subjects, I'm listening to Van, Adam, Christopher, callers like Allie, and I think there's two things that come to mind. Individually, if you tell me, okay, Evan, you're a teacher, and this child in your class is living in an impoverished home, I'm not going to assume that that child can't learn. I'm not going to assume that that child can't be great at everything and succeed and rise above some challenges. However, if you tell me that there's my classroom has kids, all the kids are in impoverished households, and the classroom next door has zero kids in impoverished situations, I can tell you that on a broader scale, you better believe there's going to be challenges, because poverty isn't about, as Allie's point, it doesn't necessarily say anything, but it is predictive of more likely to be single parent, more likely to be trauma, violence, not always. But more likely, it is more predictive of it, which is why we need to speak on the macro and individually try to pull everybody.
Yeah, and when you have concentration of poverty, you have less attention from those who could help. You have less clout with those who could help. So, of course, it matters. But listen, it's not like city kids have issues and suburban kids don't. Suburban kids have issues too. As a matter of fact, there were some recent studies that showed that children in the suburbs, especially in wealthy suburbs, are much more likely to be left alone by the adults in their lives for longer periods of time and have less communication than children in neighborhoods like the ones we serve. And the studies indicated that that impediment, right, is no less serious than severe poverty even would be. So I think really it's a question of how do we stop decontextualizing education from the rest of children's lives, wherever they are, suburbs, rural, urban. In other words, how do we stop pretending that kids are naturally schizophrenic, that they will act differently in a school environment than they would for the other 81% of the time, where they're not in a school? We only have them for about 19% of the time if you do the math. So educating kids well is part and parcel and inseparable from raising kids well. And we have to take their realities before and after school into account if we want them to benefit from what happens inside the school.
And then I think about the help that teachers may get. And the commissioner brought up mentoring. And let me just read this email from Mary Lou. She says, Ms. Elia has discussed a program of mentorship for new teachers. It's something RCSD desperately needs to improve. My son is a high school math teacher, currently in his ninth year, and is developing into a fine teacher. However, the first 2 to 3 years were so stressful, I was afraid he would have a nervous breakdown. He did not receive nearly enough meaningful support. That's from Mary Lou. Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because apparently the commissioner has been so busy that she hasn't learned that we have the premier teacher mentoring program in the nation, that her district, where she was superintendent, learned it from us with $500 million support from the Gates Foundation, that the National Commission on Teaching in America's Future singled out the Rochester Mentor Program as the model for all mentor programs in this country. It's probably the most successful reform we've had. And anyone who gets hired in our district must agree to become an intern in that mentor program. So we've had it in existence for so long that now every single teacher in our district has gone through the mentoring program and receives precisely the kind of support that this caller or writer to the show indicates that her relative yearned for and did not receive. It must have been in some other district, not in the city school district.
Okay, Van?
Yeah, I was just going to add on the issue of, you know, talking about the suburbs. My personal background is I spent 10 years of my life in the city. We lived in the city corner of Clinton and Collingwood and went to 50 school, 22 school. And then when I was 10 years old, we moved out to the town of Brighton. I mention that because I have a little experience in terms of life in the suburbs. 10 years of my life I spent in the suburbs. Brighton, very affluent community. I used to hang out in Pittsford and had friends in Rush Henrietta. So I know what is happening there. And this is how this connects to poverty. In Brighton, and no offense to Brighton, but and I know this exists in other suburban communities throughout this community. There are people who are alcoholics. There are people who engage in domestic violence, substance abuse, mental health issues, domestic violence. All the issues that we have in the city that the emailer referenced exist in the suburbs, all right? The difference is they have the resources to deal with them. And by resource, I don't just mean material resources. In other words, they have the social workers, the counselors, the therapists, the money to hire the lawyer to get out of trouble, the connections with the uncle who's a judge. Many of those resources don't exist for city residents. So, and the reason why they don't exist is because of generational poverty. So I know this emailer wasn't suggesting this, but I don't want anybody to think that there's a different moral inadequacy. There's an inadequacy from a moral perspective that exists for people who live in the city or people who are, live in poverty. The problems that I saw as a prosecutor, that I see less frequently as a defense lawyer, are the same problems that I see in the classroom. These are problems that people who are black and white, rich and poor, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, experience, but they have the capacity to address them with resources that are available. The same challenges that result in a child going into the courtroom into the city are the same problems that people experience in the suburbs, but they have resources to divert them away from that. I think sometimes when we have, and that's where the conversation about poverty and race can overlap. Racism can overlap because people begin to think, those people in the city. And I'm not suggesting that emailer was suggesting that.
Point.
But I think when people hear that, when they hear the problems that we have in the city, poverty, it's not too difficult for people to jump from that conversation to a conversation about race, and that can quickly and unknowingly turn into a conversation that is racist.
Mm-hmm. And Christopher, as a teacher in Brockport, apart from the city school district, someone who's been very successful, you're the New York State Teacher of the Year. Do you see the mentorship in districts like yours that teachers need?
We do. I have mentored 4 teachers in my district, and we have training out in Brockport that for people to become teacher mentors, and for the first year they're in our district, whether they have experience or not, are required to have a teacher mentor to get them acclimated to our school district. And I think it's a very teacher-friendly, confidential, so it's a great program that you don't have to report back to administration as a mentor or anything. You can be very confidential with the person you're mm-hmm. mentoring, and it allows for you to talk about things that they might be a little nervous in their first year to talk about. So, I feel like we have the same support system that President White talked about in the Rochester City School District. But I want to go back to something mm-hmm. that President White said right there, and that is a common misconception. We tend to equate poverty mm-hmm. and race, and that is extremely, you're right, that is a very racial statement right there. Yes, we do have a concentration of minorities in the city of Rochester, and yes, we do have a concentration of poverty in Rochester. But that's not to say that those challenges right there, and I don't see a concentration being a challenge necessarily of when it comes to race, but the challenge of poverty is only one piece of the puzzle right there. The empowerment of families and families getting interested in education and doing what's right by their children is the number one factor for success. Parents that are investing their lives in their children, that factor right there, whether it's family, parents, whoever that child's living with, in my opinion, is the number one factor for the success of that child. It is the role of the school then to recognize when that is not going right, to try to help that adult see the light and try to bring their children to that positive atmosphere so they can feel success. When you feel the gift of success of education, you realize that what you're getting. But a lot of these children, the ones that are struggling, are coming from families that do not have that vision that academics equals a way to get out of my situation. So what Mr. Urbanski said earlier is very relevant right there. They need to see the value of their education.
You want to add to that, Adam?
Well, you know, I begin with the assumption, I think we all should, that parents love their children and they want what's best for them. All parents. I mean, of course, there are exceptions. There are exceptions to every rule, but the overwhelming majority of parents, and it's safe to assume that parents love their children and want what's best for them. But if you have to work two or three jobs, and if you have to worry about the next, making the payments for next month and so forth, you could use some support. And that's why we need to have schools that reach out to families. I liked the fact that the commissioner mentioned favorably the development of community schools. We need community schools. We need to attend to our students' lives before and after school if we want them to do better in school.
All right, let's keep it tight. Go back to the phones. This is Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There's been a lot of discussion here about the focus on poverty, but there's not a lot of focus on the behaviors that contribute to poverty. You know, the chronic absenteeism rate in the Rochester City School District is still, it's got to be orders of magnitude higher on what it is than what it is in suburban schools. And if you're not there, it's really hard to educate somebody. I mean, XXI just published a story, it was last February, on an effort called Coal Can't Stop Us, where absenteeism rates actually went up in the winter. You'd think it'd be going up in the spring or fall, but it was actually the winter. It seems like we paid more attention to that. You can't really be successful if you're not there.
Okay, Robert, thank you. I'll start with you, Van. What do you say to that?
Well, I think clearly they got to be in the seats to learn. And folks who hear me talk to our leaders every week, we meet 7:30 in the morning with our building principals, and the first benchmark, the first performance indicator that I look at is where their attendance is at. You know, and in New York State, Commissioner Mills, it's going back quite a few commissioners, educated me that you got to be about 90-something percent to have effective classroom instruction going on. We have many schools where it does falls far below that. So I understand what the caller is saying, and I do believe that the person that is first responsible for that is mom or dad or aunt or uncle. And there is no excuse for not getting your child to school. However, connecting what Adam said is, you got, and again, I'm not, folks who look at me sometimes think I'm unsympathetic, too harsh on parents. I've heard colleagues say that about me. But I will say this, listen, and I say this not as a lawyer, not as a school board member, I got my kids out of bed. And it was tough, right? And I walked them to number 12 school, my two oldest. I walked them to 12 school. That's in the winter and when the weather was nice, right? When I had to go to work. Now, here's the reality, though. My circumstance, although I wasn't living large, is different from the parent that Adam talks about, the parent who's working two and three jobs. That can complicate things a bit. Now, it's not an excuse. If anybody's listening, and anybody who says, well, they got to get their kids to school, I'm speaking to the parents. Get your babies to school. However, there is the reality of many parents' lives. They're working two and three jobs. Who babysits the kid when the older ones go off to school and the little one's sitting in school? Who pays for daycare? It can get very complicated with poverty. And let me just sum up on this point. I think that's where it's the responsibility of government, not to take away the responsibility, ultimate responsibility of parents to get their kids to school on time, but to provide the resources that they have in Brighton and Pittsford and Rica to get their kids to school. So we have to, again, poverty is not an excuse, but if you don't understand why a child may not be getting to school, you're gonna be part of the problem. We have to understand that many of our parents are working two or three jobs. They're not just chilling out, not doing nothing. They're working two and three jobs. And what I hear a lot, let me give you an example. What I hear a lot is that the older child has to, but he's not so old that he has to go to school on his own, but that leaves a little child at home. Do you put the younger child, I've heard of this, in the stroller, in the winter, the baby in the stroller in the winter to get the other kid to school? Or do you keep the older child at home? That happens a lot in our district. No excuse, but it's an explanation.
Okay, Christopher, I know you want to add.
And that's not unique to Rochester. That's common out in Brockport as well. This comes down to one thing. Teachers, if we're going to make a difference, need to know each individual family. Every child's different. Every home is different. And I think that's what President White's getting at right there is every situation is unique. And if we don't take the time and we just generalize and say, well, you know, they're poor, therefore, but we don't know the circumstances behind it. So our obligation is early on as possible is for as teachers is to get to know our families. Administration needs to get to know the families and then reach out to those families, understanding each unique individual circumstance.
Down to about our last minute, then tell me one in 20 seconds, what didn't you hear from the commissioner or what would you put top of your list that the state or someone can do for teachers to make the work situation sort of more free to do the work you think needs to be done? Christopher.
I would say that we need to focus on the how of what we teach, not necessarily the what of what we teach. We focused on curriculum a tremendous amount over the past decade, and we need to get back to management and the way we work with our communities. I think that is extremely crucial in today's world where there's a lot of fractures.
Okay. Adam Urbanski.
I would like for the commissioner, who I believe has an open mind to doing things differently, to do what she can to make it possible for those who want to try more promising approaches to actually do that.
Okay, Van White.
Yeah, I heard her say during the course of the interview that the district hadn't moved the mark. And I think it's important that she communicate facts in a way that provides hope. So in other words, when I started in 2006, graduation rate, four-year graduation rate was 39%. In 2014-15, it's 46%. Last year, it's 51-52%. The reason why it's important for her to accurately state the facts is not because there's a board member that's looking for credit or superintendent's looking for credit, but those numbers represent people, and people need hope, and progress is the fuel of hope. So she needs to accurately communicate. Now, I would say, in fact, we may need a distinguished educator, someone to step in and help us and dialogue with us, but she needs to accurately communicate the facts because this community is making progress, and they need to understand that to build hope.
Van White is the City School Board President. Nice to have you, Van. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
President of the Rochester Teachers Association, Adam Urbanski. Nice having you, Adam.
Thank you.
And he wears the crown for a little while longer. Christopher Albrecht is the New York State Teacher of the Year.
I share the crown with every teacher in the state.
You're very kind. Thank you for being here, as always. Our thanks to Rob Braden. Happy birthday, Rob. Engineer Megan Mack, producer. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow.